Welcome to Power Play for December 15th. Today, Mike Duffy unleashed unfriendly fire against his senatorial sponsor, various backstabbers, and what he calls a thug in the red chamber. Our Katie Simpson can't wait to fill you in on the suspended senator's blast at the bench. Also ahead on today's show, two political prescriptions for physician-assisted dying have been produced. The federal report was handed in today, and we will talk to the co-chair of the provincial advisory group, which has just submitted its advice on how to help people die with dignity. And when General Motors was hit with an economic hammer, taxpayers bailed out the company. With more than 60,000 layoffs in the Alberta oil patch, the government reaction so far, crickets. We will ask the Natural Resources Minister what his government can do to help. And today's Power Player of the Year may have inadvertently delivered the biggest boost to the federal Liberals. We will talk to the woman who sparked a great campaign debate which moved voter support into the red. But first, the final Truth and Reconciliation Report is out. The 94 wide-ranging recommendations were tabled 5 months ago, but they are getting new life under Liberal rule.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has finished its mandate. The hope of our commission for reconciliation in the future is that we as adults can make a commitment to the children of the future, our children, our grandchildren and their grandchildren, that we will do what we can today to make their world of tomorrow a better place.
The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly. At the same time, today, there is reason for hope. No relationship is more important to me and to Canada than the one with First Nations, the Métis Nation, and Inuit peoples. Let me say it once again. I give you my word that we will renew and respect that relationship.
Very emotional, Prime Minister. Okay, the government has already put into motion an inquiry into murdered and missing Aboriginal women and girls, but there are plenty of other calls to action in the final report. They want to repeal the Criminal Code Section 43 that allows use of force to correct children, that so-called spanking law. They want to enact an Aboriginal Languages Act, establish a National Council for Reconciliation. The Pope should apologize to survivors, their families and communities. A national statutory holiday should be established for truth and reconciliation. And they want to add the phrase to the oath of citizenship to include that we will observe, faithfully observe, the laws of Canada, including treaties with Indigenous peoples. Well, let's get reaction to this defining document, a residential school's history that the Cult Commission describes as a cultural genocide. A national disgrace is born out of education, really cannot be reconciled, some would argue, without elevating education standards on reserve to off-reserve standards. Our Indigenous Affairs Minister will be joining us live in minutes, but let's first bring in Roberta Jameson. She's arguably Canada's best-known advocate for enhanced education on First Nations. That's the fast track to a more hopeful future. The President and CEO of Inspire joins me live. Roberta Jameson, what do you see in this report that gives you hope for a better future for the kids these days?
Well, I think the essential message, Dawn, is it's not called truth and reconciliation by chance. I think we've heard the truth, and now we have to move on to reconciliation. And quite appropriately, Justice Sinclair has issued calls to action. And I am a very action-oriented individual, as I think you know. And I want to see every young Indigenous student who is in primary school today graduate from high school and go on to post-secondary education. And they won't do it without support, without curriculum that validates who they are as Indigenous people. And that's really what I'm focused on.
Yeah, and right now there's a huge cost imbalance, or certainly a spending imbalance, between students on First Nations and those in sort of the regular school system. I assume that's what you're arguing has to be remedied very quickly.
We need to close that gap. It's not by accident that only 4 out of 10 First Nations children graduate from high school versus 8 out of 10 Canadian children otherwise non-Indigenous. And that has everything to do with underfunded schools, teachers that need tools to work with, and support for our students when they get into college and university.
How do you make school more attractive to students on First Nations? Like, there's huge absenteeism rates. As you point out, the dropout rate is horrendous. Mm-hmm. What needs to be added? I mean, you can throw a lot of money at it, but don't you have to have a greater sort of cultural compatibility, if you will, with these students?
Absolutely. Our students need to see themselves in the curriculum. They need to see that their stories are being told. They need to see that cultural values that we hold are in the sciences, are in the maths. And you know, there are educators out there working very hard. There are resources. This is achievable. I'm here to tell Canadians we can change this picture and we can do it in this generation if we get taking some serious steps. And that's what inspired us. We support educators in the classroom. We support students in university, and Justice Sinclair called for greater numbers of our students to graduate from post-secondary because they are the change agents in our communities. And I'm very proud that this last year we supported 5,000 bursaries to students, but you know what, Dawn? We're only meeting 16% of the need. So there are students out there who can change life for their communities and the country if they are supported.
I know we've had a lot of reports that have sounded very good, like the Kelowna Accord, for example, under Paul Martin, dealt with education in a big way, multi-billion dollar commitments, and it fizzled under the Stephen Harper government. They made a lot of noise. They were going to correct it. Not much has happened to improve the situation. What makes you think now is any different? What do you think we've actually reached a tipping point of some kind here?
Yes, I do. I think that Canadians, as never before, are galvanized around wanting to create change. And it's governments, it's our own leadership in our Indigenous communities, it's corporate Canada, it's individual Canadians. I meet Canadians every day who really want to make a difference. They want to change the picture in the future. They have heard about the past, they've heard the painful truths, and they want to move forward, and they want to be part of that picture.
Roberta Jameson, you know, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. You're one of the most articulate and coherent people we have on this show, and we thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Dawn.
Okay, there's no easy segue to my next topic, but it is the other big news story of the day. Mike Duffy, he sounded a bit like a cornered political animal in court today, forced to confess to mistakes he didn't consider to be wrongdoings. Well, let's pick up the sixth day of Duffy on the stand as he let loose on the nemesis who named him to the Senate. CTV's Katie Simpson has just returned from the courthouse. She joins us live.
Hi.
Hello. You were just having a wonderful time today.
It was an interesting day. It's certainly, you know, some of these days have been not exactly the most exciting days in court, but today was one of the more interesting for sure.
Let's bring in a picture.
Okay.
Let's start with a picture. It's always very interesting.
There.
This was a picture the Prime Minister's office took at a moment when some people would argue this is where Mike Duffy realized his goose was cooked, as he described it. Tell us about that picture, Katie.
Okay, setting the scene. This is when the Senate expense scandal is really heating up. It's February of 2013. There's a lot of pressure growing on Duffy, according to his testimony today, that he needs to pay back the money, and he needs to do it. He doesn't think he should have to pay it back. He doesn't think he's done anything wrong, and he says he's resisting all the way. So he decides after caucus, one day, he's going to corner the Prime Minister and say, look, I didn't do it. There's nothing wrong here. Don't make me do this. He was telling the Prime Minister, it's going to ruin my life. I feel like I've been railroaded here. What are you making me do here? And he says the Prime Minister said to him during this conversation that just happened to be caught by the Prime Minister's official photographer. Duffy doesn't think the PMO photog knew what the context was, but in this moment, Duffy claims that the Prime Minister said to him, I know it seems unfair, I know you didn't break the rules, but the rules are inexplicable to the base. You're going to have to make the payment, you're going to have to pay the money back, and Nigel will make the arrangements.
Giant a giant circle of people came around him and were forcing him to do stuff he didn't want, the way I was reading it. I mean, Carolyn Stewart Olson, she's a senator.
He says there was pressure from everywhere. and then he goes on in court saying all these people were calling him, whether they were friends, whether they were who were members of the Conservative Party, whether they were fellow senators. And then he goes on to say Vern White, Senator Vern White, who's a former, I believe he's the former police chief in Ottawa.
Yeah.
He called him a thug. He goes, I shouldn't say this in court, but that thug, Vern White, he kept pressuring me and telling me I had to do it. It was the right thing. And so he said the pressure was building, and the House was about to come back in mid-February. It was a break week in the Senate. He'd gone home to PEI. He was there. He was by himself. He was feeling lonely, vulnerable. He felt he had been fed to the lions, whipped, thrown under the bus, felt like a leper. All of these things, he finally said, I give up. He was going to do it, and he agreed to go on TV and do the mistake repay scenario, which was apparently concocted by the Prime Minister's office to make this whole political scandal go away. He says he was told repeatedly by everyone in a position of authority, including the Prime Minister, that if he did this, it would go away, and it was the right thing to do. Duffy didn't want to do it because he said it would ruin his reputation. It would wreck his career that he'd built so hard to, he'd worked so hard to build. He didn't want to do it, but he went along with it because he was ordered to do so by the Prime Minister. And that's a direct quote from him at the end of court today, saying he was ordered by the Prime Minister of Canada to do this, to make this scandal go away, to take it out of the headlines, and so that Tom Mulcair would stop asking Stephen Harper about it in the House of Commons.
What was it? He used a phrase to describe what it was like going on television. He described it. How did he describe it?
So Duffy has, and there is evidence that was presented in court. All of these emails where Duffy says he doesn't want to do this. Right. He doesn't believe he's in the wrong, and he discussed conversations about how he repeatedly told people in authority he didn't want to do it. When he finally agrees to do it, he said he felt like a North Korean prisoner of war sitting there regurgitating rehearsed lines on behalf of his dictators. So that happened in court today. He said he did not want to go along with it, and that's how he felt, and that happened.
Talk about the $90,000 check. I mean, we started this yesterday, mm-hmm. but today he explained it further. What was he saying about that?
Well, he said he didn't know the money came from Nigel Wright, and then he questioned it in court, saying, why would Nigel Wright write me a check, saying it's crazy? And he said he also didn't want to accept the money to begin with because he didn't want to have to pay someone or something back because he felt he didn't owe the money, and it wasn't, his expenses were not improper. And he said all along he thought it was the Conservative Party that was paying for it. It was the Conservative Fund. They were taking care of it. He didn't know it was Nigel Wright until later it came out.
I mean, is it plausible? I mean, I guess it is plausible. I mean, the Conservative Party always circles the wagons when they're hit by hostile forces, and they've thrown enough people under the bus.
Well, Duffy described in court today that he feels he was tossed right under that bus. Yeah. He was stabbed in the back. They built the scaffold. They are building the gallows. And these are all things he said in court. I'm not exaggerating. These are like actual things that Duffy said in court today. It was quite dramatic, and it was very theatrical.
Yeah. Well, so how do you describe his demeanor? Like, what was he like? I mean, you're talking like an Energizer bunny, yet this guy's produced evidence that he's medically, basically, in his dying days.
Well, and he talked about his medical condition and said that the stress and the pressure and everything was going on culminated in another open-heart surgery at the end of 2013, and the pressure and stress. And Don Bain, his lawyer, was going through his medical. He keeps tabs on his blood sugars, and he had big sugar swings, and he wasn't feeling well, and all of the pressure that was building up to him to make this decision to finally say, on television, he said falsely that he made a mistake, he was going to repay, he just wanted to turn the page. But his demeanor, he was energetic today, I'll say that for sure, but he's always wanted to tell his side of the story, and now that Don Bain is done, his defense lawyer is done questioning him, he is done telling his story in his own words. Tomorrow, the Crown will cross-examine him.
Ooh, I can't wait for that one, too. All right,
we'll
see you tomorrow, I guess. All right, Katie, Bye. Thank you. Up next, the federal government's move towards doctor-assisted death has been given an expert report to frame its consultations. We will talk to a key member on the provincial panel, which released its findings yesterday. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, while we wait for the federal government to meet its court-ordered deadline on assisted death legislation, the provinces are pondering how they would administer the future federal law. A federal report to frame this blitz, a consultation blitz, was given to the Justice Minister today, but the Province and Territorial Task Force on the issue was also just released. That report recommends public funding for assisted dying services, that eligibility should be based on competency, not age. Additional training should be provided for healthcare professionals. The government would allow competent patients to make advanced directives for assisted death, and it seeks other oversight provisions, including witnessed patient declaration forms and a requirement that patients are assessed by two physicians. Okay, Jennifer Gibson is co-chair of the Provincial Territorial Advisory Group on Physician-Assisted Dying. She joins me from Toronto. Dr. Gibson, you've defined the conditions for those who could be assisted to die. What are they?
Well, you know, where we started from was the Carter ruling, which stipulated that someone who was eligible for physician-assisted death needed to be a competent adult, needed to be able to consent to and make the request and to consent to physician-assisted death, and needed to have a grievous and irremediable medical condition that was causing enduring and intolerable suffering to that individual.
Right. Now, one thing that got a bit of a headline pop yesterday was you sort of suggested that there not be an impediment in terms of age limits, but I don't think you're suggesting children be allowed to make the decision. But what does that mean for children?
Well, you know, we never talk about children in the report. What we're really talking about is really focusing on somebody's competence, their ability to understand their options, to appreciate the consequences of those options, to be able to make decisions in relation to their values, and to be able then to consent in an informed way to physician-assisted death. Now, what we have across Canada, indeed already, is a recognition that mature minors, these could be adolescents, are often competent to make treatment decisions. And so if you look province to province, many of the provinces do not actually have a defined age of consent. Rather, what they focus on is what is the mature minor rule that says, look, if you're competent, even if you happen to be 16 years old, to be able to make this particular decision, then it's your right to be able to do so.
Okay, particularly horrifying scenario to be confronting, but I appreciate it has
Indeed.
To be done.
Explain
to our viewers why we have a federal government looking at a consultation and the provinces looking at a consultation. I mean, I always thought healthcare was a provincial responsibility under the Constitution. Why do we have this dueling legislative battle going on?
You know, Don, that's a great question, and in fact, it's one we're often asked. And I think what we need to be able to be clear on here is that the federal government does have jurisdiction in this area precisely because the Supreme Court of Canada stipulated that there ought to be amendments to the criminal code. The criminal code is under the federal jurisdiction, and by carving out a special permission for physicians to participate in physician-assisted death, then indeed the federal government does have a role. But you're absolutely right. Provinces and territories have primary jurisdiction over health, and for that reason, the provinces and territories, 11 out of the 13 of them, came together to create the expert advisory group to develop a framework, a set of guidelines and advice from the expert advisory group for the provinces and territories that would help to inform the development of legislation that would be applied within those jurisdictions. But of course, we are waiting to find out what the federal government will do in terms of the criminal code, so that will provide, that will inform what the provinces and territories do, but ultimately their jurisdiction will be defined by the legislation that they develop, and hopefully our guidance, our advice, will be able to inform that process.
Well, how does what your scenarios you're outlining in this report differ from what's going on in Quebec right now? Because they're moving ahead on that, subject to another court challenge that's coming up.
That's right, and there are a number of differences. One is that, indeed, Quebec has narrowly defined the conditions under which somebody might be able to access physician-assisted death to terminal conditions, which is something that the Carter decision did not do. They left the field much wider to non-terminal conditions as well. Another distinction, too, is that in Quebec, the focus is on physician-administered death, whereas our recommendations have opened up the possibility, as is in the case in Oregon, where it could be self-administered as well. Quebec has said no to advance directives, and we've left room in our recommendations to allow that, in large part due to some of the consultation that we've had with stakeholders across the country. There are a number of other differences as well, but I think philosophically where we're agreed is that physician-assisted death ought to be part of a continuum of supports and services for persons at the end of their lives. And so this is why one of our strong recommendations is for the provinces and territories to come together on a pan-Canadian strategy on end-of-life care, including palliative care and physician-assisted death.
Dr. Gibson, a pleasure chatting with you. We'll keep an eye on this issue. It's one
Thanks, Don.
That impacts a lot of people. Thank you.
It will. Thank you very much.
All right. As I pointed out, Quebec's already acted on assisted dying, but that's not what we're going to talk about, because we're going to continue our discussion of regions and give the political checkup on as 2015 comes to a close, and we're going to go to Quebec for that. Jean Lapierre is a commentator on everything that moves in that province, and he joins us live from Montreal. All right, Jean, you got Pierre Couillard. He's in year two, I guess. How's he doing, in your view, as the Premier of Quebec?
Frankly, Philippe Couillard has succeeded in one thing. We know that we're going to have a balanced budget next year. He's survived that while keeping social peace and, frankly, being ahead still in the polls, because his first 2 years were the worst ones, because, I mean, we were talking about cuts and austerity and what have you. Also, he had to negotiate with the public service, and he did cut spending. And still survives. And, you know, we were afraid of social unrest, you know, like we had with the students at a certain time. Well, that hasn't happened. There was no real mobilization. And he's about to have a deal with the public service, the 550,000 public servants. So he's done pretty well to everybody's surprise, because everybody thought that, you know, those first 2 years were going to be so difficult that he would, you know, be back... you know, in the polls, he would be last in the polls and things like that. That didn't materialize at all.
Okay, but he has a new rival, someone that wants that job from him. Pierre Carapelado is the new PQ leader elected this year. Is he a gift to Premier Couillard or a threat in the future? How do you see that shaking out?
Well, the first thing is that the PQ thought that they had a savior, a messiah. And frankly, Pierre Carapelado hasn't proven to be that at all. As a matter of fact, he's not much of a good politician as of now. He's got quite a learning curve. I mean, you know, it shows the difference between a good businessman and being a politician. There's almost nothing in common. And so not only that, the fact that he still says that his only objective, his only goal in politics is to make Quebec a country, obviously for Philippe Couillard, when you look at all the polls, sovereignty is around, independence is around, you know, 35 to 40%. That means that, you know, if you have a polarized electorate, which, you know, Pierre Carapelado does provoke, well, then it's pretty good for the Liberals. And that's also their danger, because right now they're looking across the aisle. They see Pierre Carapelado, who's a diehard sovereignist, who's a hardliner, and who doesn't perform well. And they see also the second opposition party, the CAQ, with François Legault, that is almost suicidal politically. So they think that, you know, they've got it made for the next 2 years and the next election. And that's where you become arrogant, that's where you become complacent, and that's where you're in trouble. And that's exactly the danger that the Liberals are running into at this time. They see that their opposition is weak, and then, you know, the press becomes the real opposition. And sometimes the street also becomes the real opposition. So that's the danger they're playing with at this time.
Okay, but Mr. Premier Couillard did help partially bail out Bombardier. I think it was $1 billion or so. I'm curious how Prime Minister Trudeau should deal with that. Obviously, if he responds with a handout, that might be good politics, but it might be bad policy. How do you see that?
Well, I don't think anybody will want a direct handout. It will have to be some type of a loan, some type of participation. Grants are not that popular these days. But obviously, if you want to save the aerospace industry in Canada, it goes through Bombardier. I mean, that's what the French are doing with Airbus. That's what the Americans are doing to Boeing. That's what is happening also with Embraer. So obviously, if we want to have a Canadian industry, we've got to support it. Now, Up to now, the Prime Minister Trudeau has reacted positively, saying, you know, that his minister is studying the case. He wants to have a strong business case, so he has not closed the door. But obviously, a no would be very difficult to accept, especially the fact that the province, the Caisse de dépôt has gone with over $1 billion, and the province has gone with over $1 billion. But if we want to have a national industry, I don't think only a province can support it.
Very quickly on this, I just want to get your take of the temperature of federal politics there. Is the orange NDP wave officially a riptide now that's going backwards, or do you think it's got a possibility of a resurgence coming up if it keeps going over the next 3-4 years like this?
Oh, my gosh, they'll have quite a job, because right now, I must say that Mr. Mulcair is nowhere to be seen. Prime Minister Trudeau is really taking all the space, and, you know, his last visit this week with Premier Couillard, I mean, that was the type of loving that the last time I saw something like that was Mr. Bourassa and Brian Mulroney. So in 1984, where we really had, you know, quite a good rapport between Ottawa and Quebec, and the meeting between Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Couillard was a reminder of those good years of 1984 and so on. So, okay. I mean, Mr. Trudeau is taking all the media space, and the honeymoon is still on with Quebecers as well.
All right. John, thanks very much for filling us in. If I don't talk to you next week, we'll talk to you in the new year. Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, Canada's Indigenous Affairs Minister will discuss how far the government will go and how much it will spend on implementing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's exhaustive recommendations. Please stay with us. All right, a half day of speeches ended late this afternoon as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission wrapped up years of work. The heavy lifting now shifts to the government minister on the file. Indigenous Affairs Minister Carolyn Bennett joins me live. Welcome to the show, Minister. Lots of talk about new beginnings today, and it's a massive document that spans like all levels of government, obligations on everybody. Where do you begin?
It's a great question, but I'm going to start with the last line, which is the reason why all Canadians need to engage in this reconciliation is in order for our children and grandchildren to thrive, Indigenous, non-Indigenous. This is about the future of Canada. And so, you know, the commission studied the last seven generations. Our job is to put in place something that'll work for the next seven generations.
I agree, but you know, you've known about these recommendations for 6 months now, and you might not have known you were going to be the minister in charge of them. But there must be a priority emphasis on this. I mean, I know the Prime Minister said the UN, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is going to be a priority. But where do you go after that?
Well, that's sort of a blueprint in terms of how we work across all ministries and with the premiers and the mayors, the private sector. The way the calls to action are organized, they put children first. And I think that's always, we always think that that's something that won't wait. Children need and deserve the best start in life. And right. We still have more kids in foster care than at the height of residential schools. So, you know, I think that's where I also think, I mean, we've launched the inquiry in missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but I think in the new year that we want to do a proper piece of work with the help of Cindy Blackstock and hopefully Charlie Angus and the Parliamentary Committee. There's mm-hmm. I think a lot of people feel that the Tina Fontaine death galvanized a nation, but that's about a child right. in care.
Yeah, we had Roberta Jameson on to open the show, and you know she's a big advocate for this. And she says, look, you cannot have this funding disparity. First Nations versus school boards like Ottawa School Board. You know, the kids have, it's two different realms. You've got to bring them up to the same level. That's expensive.
Well, we're lucky that the previous government did book some money for closing that gap. So there is some money in the fiscal framework for Canada right now. Okay. So that can get us on that way of closing the gap, the per student per year. And also there's money, we've promised money for schools, but it's unacceptable that a child going to a a school in a, on a First Nations community is paid less than per student than if they're in the provincial system. So yeah, we have to close that.
And how quickly might that happen? I'm always pressing you for timelines, and that's not fair, I understand that, but I think people are saying that you got to seize the moment in some ways, that there's a strong emotional wallop that's come down with this, and if you don't act quickly, you'll lose that momentum.
But I mean, in the platform, we committed to beginning to close the gap. I think mm-hmm. that if you talk to Roberta or Paul Martin or anybody else, they'll know it's still not enough.
Right.
But we will make a good start on that commitment, and we are, you know, it's really important to get great teachers and great principals and have them stay, and schools that, you know, don't make kids sick. And so I think that's an exciting beginning.
Reconciliation talks a lot. It's reflected in a lot of symbols, like there's talk of a day that would be dedicated to truth and reconciliation, a national monument for them, the Pope delivering an apology here. First of all, I have an idea. We had that Victims of Communism Memorial that's probably going next to the Supreme Court. Why don't we make that the Truth and Reconciliation National Monument?
I don't think you're the first person to say that.
No, I've advocated for it in the past. I'm sure others have too.
But I think that there needs to be a monument. You know, again, it's one of the calls to action. It's something very easily in our court. I think it would have to be done with the survivors and their families to make sure that it's what they need in terms of their therapeutic and again meets their expectations of what that would look like. But I think that on other things, you know, the provinces and territories are already getting going on the curriculum. And as the Prime Minister said, we never learned any of this in school. And so how do we quickly move on curricular changes that can make that happen? The universities are already, like University of Winnipeg, making compulsory, mandatory, courses in Indigenous studies. When I graduated from the University of Toronto, you couldn't graduate unless you could swim a length of the pool. I don't think that it's too much to say that people graduating from a Canadian university should have to have at least one course in Indigenous studies.
Good point. The Pope, are you actually going to ask him to come over and apologize? I know people are fascinated by that for some reason, but...
Well, you know, it's interesting in terms of what that request looks like. It's there on paper.
Yeah.
The Pope's already apologized in South America. But, you know, I think there, from Kairos to many Catholics across this country, many priests, bishops, cardinals, you know, I think maybe the Pope will just do it on his own.
Never know. Carolyn Bennett, it's a pleasure having you on. Thank you. And you got a tough job ahead of you.
I look forward to it.
All right, thank you.
Coming up,
the oil price collapse is hitting Alberta particularly hard, so we've asked the Natural Resources Minister in charge of the oil patch what his government can do to help. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, Calgary offices are emptying out as pink slip showers fall over the Alberta oil patch. We caught up with Natural Resources Minister Jim Carr at the National Arts Centre today for a chat on the faltering horsepower of Canada's economic engine. Okay, Minister Carr, in some people's calculations, we're actually around $22 in oil for some of the heavy crude that's coming out of Alberta. How concerned are you about that?
Well, concerned for people who are losing their jobs, and you always care most about the human dimension, and we're going through a very difficult period in the energy sector, particularly oil and gas, and it has consequences on families. The Government of Canada wants to grow the economy, understanding that it must be done sustainably, and we will be announcing major investments in clean technology, and I believe in the entrepreneurship and the innovation of the entrepreneur right across the country, and particularly in Alberta. And they've displayed that time and time again, and I'm sure they'll display it again, which doesn't cushion the blow for those who are suffering now.
Mm-hmm.
But I am hopeful that given this new climate and this new sense of the green economy that's in front of us, that we will succeed.
I know a lot of people aren't aware of how big the impact of the oil patch is beyond Alberta and Saskatchewan.
Yeah,
this is a major hit on our economy, too. Is that going to cause you trouble down the road in terms of...
Well, we see it as opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we have a chance now in partnership with Indigenous communities, with those who are innovative and the entrepreneurial spirit of Canadians, to take advantage of this moment and be competitive internationally. and for Canada to excel internationally in the production of clean technology as we move through this difficult period.
Your mandate letter also deals with starting to move more aggressively with your allies, particularly the United States and Mexico.
Yep.
There was always talk that we had to match our regulations to the U.S., mm-hmm. particularly in the oil and gas sector. Do you see that coming out quickly, some sort of in tandem movement to go in that direction?
I do. As a matter of fact, we've invited the American Secretary of Energy, Secretary Moniz, and the Mexican Secretary of Energy Caldwell to come to Winnipeg in February for a trilateral meeting of ministers of North America. And as you say, the Prime Minister has given me a mandate to move that agenda forward. And I can't think of a better place to do that than in Winnipeg.
They accepted in February?
They did.
Winnipeg?
They sure did.
Did they check the weather forecast for that?
No, I think they see it as an exotic experience.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, quick
for
final.
For me, it's home.
Final point, though. But yeah. You also are the Minister of Pipelines. And yeah. There is pressure to try and get more product to market, even though it is heavily discounted right now. Mm-hmm. The Harper government, as we know, did not get a centimeter of pipeline built, but when can we see something out of this government?
You'll see a transition period of the regulatory system into the new year. We have said that the proponents of those projects that are currently being reviewed won't have to go back to square one, but there will be a transition phase that will incorporate the principles in our platform and in the mandate letter. And then in the longer term, there'll be a new way of regulating and environmental assessment and a modernization also of the National Energy Board.
Mr. Carr, thanks for joining us. Appreciate
it's my
that.
Pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
After these messages, we'll chat with another of our power players of the year and discuss what she did to star in and perhaps shape the outcome of the October election campaign. Please stay with us.
I can't hear the show either.
Welcome back. Well, all she wanted was freedom of clothing choice when taking the oath of Canadian citizenship. But after fighting and winning that right in the courts, a 29-year-old mother from Mississauga became a hot election issue, with some belief precipitated the shift of NDP support to the Liberals. For that reason, and taking a stand on an important principle, Zuneer Ishak is one of our power players of the year. Here's what she had to say about the impact her case had on the federal election.
It was being mispropagated by the conservatives, who actually tried to gain some benefits out of it. But I think it was not how they could have. It was not according to their expectations. It did not went through like this. Rather, it is a very important issue, which led them to lose their seats in the federal election.
Well, joining us to discuss this and other issues of the day is our Tuesday Press Gallery. CTV Deputy Ottawa Bureau Chief Laurie Graham is here in the studio. And in Toronto, Toronto Star National Affairs columnist Tim Harper. Welcome to you both. Tim, I'll go to you on this first. What do you think? Did we make a right pick on her, Ms. Ishak, because of her impact on the election?
Yeah, I think that's an inspired choice, Don. It's a woman who I'm sure never dreamt that she would become a central issue in the campaign. Would actually, clearly, her case turned votes. It exposed it was a well-known and nasty side of the Conservatives, but it really came out during the campaign. And what I was impressed with, this woman never tried to exploit the fact that she had become a political player. She continued her goal just for her own principles, as you mentioned, and never really got out there and tried to become an issue. She just graciously accepted the fact that she was. And when the Liberals finally dropped the case, she had her citizenship, and she got a personal phone call from the Justice Minister to say that the case had been dropped by the new incoming government. So for her, a happy story, but I suppose she's still a very polarizing figure in the country.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with you, Tim, because Laurie's struggling to hear what's going on here. I'm curious, though, do you ever figure out in your mind why that issue stuck so stubbornly to Tom Mulcair and not costing Justin Trudeau any following, given the positions on the NECAB were virtually identical?
Yeah, and I think the New Democrats are still asking that question as well, Don. There's a lot of evidence that perhaps the NDP slide had begun before the niqab issue took off in Quebec. But, you know, Mulcair paid a price for being honest and principled, in my view. He had no choice. That was his position. He had to take his lumps in Quebec. And I think at that point there was a decision that was concurrently happening across the country that Justin Trudeau was going to be the man of change. And he seemed to, you're right, he seemed to get a free pass with an identical position. And somehow the burden of all this fell on Tom Mulcair. Speaking to Democrats, after that happened, even they were at a loss to explain to me why it fell so disproportionately on the New Democrats' shoulders. But, you know, when a wave happens, you can get away with a lot. And I think that was one perfect example of something that Justin Trudeau got a pass on because voters were seeing other attributes in him. Let's put it that way.
Now, Laura, you haven't heard any of Tim's inspired conversation.
So disappointing, Tim, because I love to hear those dulcet tones. But.
Zanira's was sort of the inadvertent campaign issue, wasn't she?
You know, it's really interesting when you talked about how the impact on the NDP. It was actually during the debate in Quebec afterward when Mr. Mulcair came out, and it was really at this point you could feel the momentum, and this niqab issue became a huge problem for him in Quebec, but it didn't affect Trudeau, and yet Trudeau and Mulcair have exactly the same position, which is there shouldn't be a ban during citizenship ceremonies. But I asked Mr. Mulcair that night, I said, you know, how difficult is it for you to be watching this transpire? You're the one wearing it when, in fact, you know, the other leader, the liberal leader, it's not hurting him at all. And I can just remember Mulcair just sort of was like shaking his head. He just sort of said, I just have to go with my convictions and I have to hope that people can understand that. But he himself knew that he was the one that had to, he had to endure what was going on. And for whatever reason, it didn't impact, you know, Trudeau at all.
Here's a weird story, and I don't know why I'm talking about it because it's sort of been recalled, but Finance Minister Bill Morneau, the Canadian press sort of said to him, what about raising the GST, and he didn't completely rule it out, so they did a story saying he hasn't ruled it out, but now he's ruled it out. But I think that begs the question, I'd like both of your thoughts on this. The government seems to be rushing into this revenue problem because the spending commitments are so high. How serious is this going to be, Lori, in your view? Because the budget's only 2-3 months away. There's no budget consultation process going to be unrolled out this year.
It's a huge problem, and there is no answer at this point. I mean, I ask specifically what other tools he has in the financial tool trunk, right, to try to deal with this. One of the things they've done is dealing with mortgage rates, making it more difficult or more expensive, at least, to try to help with the housing problem. Mm-hmm. But we heard, you know, today this could be a huge problem. There could be a crisis. Does he have any other things that he's sort of got up his sleeve that he's going to deal with? And he said, no, nothing at all. We're just watching it. Was also in the scrum today when he came out, asked again about the GST and said absolutely not, that he didn't intend to do that. But I don't doubt that there is. It is absolutely going to come back on them. They have something that they have to figure out. And, you know, he's just not being very clear about all of it.
Yeah, Tim, there was kind of, the Bank of Canada governor was a little cautious on what's going to happen to this housing market. And yet we're still facing an oil patch that's in meltdown mode. You know, the bad news continues to pile up a bit. Household debt's very high. What do you think's going to happen here as this fiscal reality hits this sunny days government?
Well, you know, Don, I got to tell you, I thought I was pretty good at debt, but this Bank of Canada report today refers to people with 350% debt, 3.5 times debt higher than their gross income per year, owing some $400 billion. Now, that is an alarming number, and these are disproportionately younger homeowners who are highly leveraged in Toronto and Vancouver. So you mentioned personal debt. It's at an all-time record level again. We know what's going on with oil prices, the value of the dollar. As Laurie says, we're speeding to a budget in a not-too-distant future. So Bill Morneau has that problem. Bill Morneau is a rookie minister, also has another problem that I think he'd be best advised to correct. He doesn't answer questions directly, and that's why you get speculation about the GST, because he couldn't say no. You remember he couldn't say that the $10 billion deficit was probably more aspirational than something that was going to happen. He wouldn't refer to a housing bubble when he did an availability dealing with housing bubbles. So I think he's got to learn, and when it comes to communication, he's also got to be a little bit more clear, because he's giving rise to all kinds of speculation, because he has a habit of skating around questions and not really giving us any answers.
Oh, he'll learn, Tim. He'll learn. Okay, quick last topic I want to get to, Lori, who wasn't reading your lips very accurately, so she doesn't know what you said again, but let's talk
how
about...
How much he misses me, that's what I read.
Ronna Ambrose, the pot party pooper. We only got 30 seconds left. She says what?
Party pooper.
She says what?
Pot's bad.
Doesn't
want it on the shelves at the LCBO with the way that
out of step with public opinion.
It seems to be out of step. She absolutely thinks it's a bad thing. They are sticking with it, and what we know right now is the government is clearly not, and it may be very well be not until the third mandate. But lots of meetings are happening behind the scenes, and premiers are coming out suggesting what they want.
Okay. I think we're out of time. Thank you very much, Lori. Thanks, Tim.
Bye, Tim.
Get you in the studio next week, okay?
Okay.
All right. That is your day in Canadian politics. Thanks very much for tuning in. Just a reminder, viewers can now get daily access to the entire show through our podcast. Just download it through our iTunes page. Scott Lori is up next with the latest news headlines. For the Power Play team, I'm Don Martin. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow at this time right here on CFD News Channel.